Disc 14.
Instead of wondering at this result of misery in Mr. Casaubon, I think it quite ordinary. Will not a tiny speck very close to our vision blot out the glory of the world, and leave only a margin by which we see the blot? I know no speck so troublesome as self. And who, if Mr. Casaubon had chosen to expound his discontents, his suspicions that he was not any longer adored without criticism, could have denied that they were founded on good reasons? On the contrary, there was a strong reason to be added, which he had not himself taken explicitly into account. Namely, that he was not unmixedly adorable. He suspected this, however, as he suspected other things, without confessing it, and, like the rest of us, felt how soothing it would have been to have a companion who would never find it out. This sore susceptibility in relation to Dorothea was thoroughly prepared before Will Ladislaw had returned to Lowick, and what had occurred since then had brought Mr. Casaubon's power of suspicious construction into exasperated activity. To all the facts which he knew, he added imaginary facts, both present and future, which became more real to him than those, because they called up a stronger dislike, a more predominating bitterness. Suspicion and jealousy of Will Ladislaw's intentions, suspicion and jealousy of Dorothea's impressions, were constantly at their weaving work. It would be quite unjust to him to suppose that he could have entered into any coarse misinterpretation of Dorothea. His own habits of mind and conduct, quite as much as the open elevation of her nature, saved him from any such mistake. What he was jealous of was her opinion, the sway that might be given to her ardent mind in its judgments, and the future possibilities to which these might lead her. As to Will, though until his last defiant letter he had nothing definite which he would choose formally to allege against him, he felt himself warranted in believing that he was capable of any design which could fascinate a rebellious temper and an undisciplined impulsiveness. He was quite sure that Dorothea was the cause of Will's return from Rome, and his determination to settle in the neighbourhood. And he was penetrating enough to imagine that Dorothea had innocently encouraged this course. It was as clear as possible that she was ready to be attached to Will, and to be pliant to his suggestions. They had never had a tête-à-tête without her bringing away from it some new troublesome impression. And the last interview that Mr. Casaubon was aware of, Dorothea, on returning from Freshitt Hall, had for the first time been silent about having seen Will, had led to a scene which roused an angrier feeling against them both than he had ever known before. Dorothea's outpouring of her notions about money in the darkness of the night had done nothing but bring a mixture of more odious foreboding into her husband's mind. And there was the shock lately given to his health, always sadly present with him. He was certainly much revived. He had recovered all his usual power of work. The illness might have been mere fatigue, and there might still be 20 years of achievement before him which would justify the 30 years of preparation. That prospect was made the sweeter by a flavour of vengeance against the hasty sneers of Carp and company. For even when Mr. Casaubon was carrying his taper among the tombs of the past, those modern figures came athwart the dim light and interrupted his diligent exploration. To convince Carp of his mistake, so that he would have to eat his own words with a good deal of indigestion, would be an agreeable accident of triumphant authorship, which the prospect of living to future ages on earth and to all eternity in heaven could not exclude from contemplation. Since thus the prevision of his own unending bliss could not nullify the bitter savours of irritated jealousy and vindictiveness, it is the less surprising that the probability of a transient earthly bliss for other persons, when he himself should have entered into glory, had not a potently sweetening effect. If the truth should be that some undermining disease was at work within him, there might be large opportunity for some people to be the happier when he was gone. And if one of those people should be Will Ladislaw, Mr. Casaubon objected so strongly that it seemed as if the annoyance would make part of his disembodied existence. This is a very bare, and therefore a very incomplete, way of putting the case. The human soul moves in many channels, and Mr. Casaubon, we know, had a sense of rectitude, and an honourable pride in satisfying the requirements of honour, which compelled him to find other reasons for his conduct than those of jealousy and vindictiveness. The way in which Mr. Casaubon put the case was this. In marrying Dorothea Brooke, I had to care for her well-being in case of my death. But well-being is not to be secured by ample, independent possession of property. On the contrary, occasions might arise in which such possession might expose her to the more danger. She is ready prey to any man who knows how to play adroitly either on her affectionate ardour or her quixotic enthusiasm. And a man stands by with that very intention in his mind, a man with no other principle than transient caprice, and who has a personal animosity towards me, I am sure of it, an animosity which is fed by the consciousness of his ingratitude, and which he has constantly vented in ridicule, of which I am as well assured as if I had heard it. Even if I live, I shall not be without uneasiness as to what he may attempt through indirect influence. This man has gained Dorothea's ear. He has fascinated her attention. He has evidently tried to impress her mind with the notion that he has claims beyond anything I have done for him. If I die, and he is waiting here on the watch for that, he will persuade her to marry him. That would be calamity for her, and success for him. She would not think it calamity. He would make her believe anything. She has a tendency to immoderate attachment, which she inwardly reproaches me for not responding to, and already her mind is occupied with his fortunes. He thinks of an easy conquest, and of entering into my nest. That I will hinder. Such a marriage would be fatal to Dorothea. Has he ever persisted in anything except from contradiction? In knowledge, he has always tried to be showy at small cost. In religion, he could be, as long as it suited him, the facile echo of Dorothea's vagaries. When was sciolism ever dissociated from laxity? I utterly distrust his morals, and it is my duty to hinder to the utmost the fulfilment of his designs. The arrangements made by Mr. Casaubon on his marriage left strong measures open to him. But in ruminating on them, his mind inevitably dwelt so much on the probabilities of his own life that the longing to get the nearest possible calculation had at last overcome his proud reticence and had determined him to ask Lydgate's opinion as to the nature of his illness. He had mentioned to Dorothea that Lydgate was coming by appointment at 3:30, and in answer to her anxious question whether he had felt ill, replied, "No, I merely wish to have his opinion concerning some habitual symptoms. You need not see him, my dear. I shall give orders that he may be sent to me in the yew tree walk, where I shall be taking my usual exercise." When Lydgate entered the yew tree walk, he saw Mr. Casaubon slowly receding, with his hands behind him according to his habit, and his head bent forward. It was a lovely afternoon. The leaves from the lofty limes were falling silently across the sombre evergreens, while the lights and shadows slept side by side. There was no sound but the cawing of the rooks, which to the accustomed ear is a lullaby. Or that last solemn lullaby, a dirge. Lydgate, conscious of an energetic frame in its prime, felt some compassion when the figure which he was likely soon to overtake turned round, and in advancing towards him, showed more markedly than ever the signs of premature age. The student's bent shoulders, the emaciated limbs, and the melancholy lines of the mouth. "Poor fellow," he thought. "Some men with his years are like lions. One can tell nothing of their age except that they are full grown." "Mr. Lydgate," said Mr. Casaubon, with his invariably polite air, "I am exceedingly obliged to you for your punctuality. We will, if you please, carry on our conversation in walking to and fro." "I hope your wish to see me is not due to the return of unpleasant symptoms," said Lydgate, filling up a pause. "Not immediately, no. In order to account for that wish, I must mention, what it were otherwise needless to refer to, that my life, on all collateral accounts insignificant, derives a possible importance from the incompleteness of labours which have extended through all its best years. In short, I have long had on hand a work which I would fain leave behind me in such a state, at least, that it might be committed to the press by others." were I assured that this is the utmost I can reasonably expect. That assurance would be a useful circumscription of my attempts, and a guide in both the positive and negative determination of my course. Here Mr. Casaubon paused, removed one hand from his back, and thrust it between the buttons of his single-breasted coat. To a mind largely instructed in the human destiny, hardly anything could be more interesting than the inward conflict implied in his formal measured address, delivered with the usual sing-song and motion of the head. Nay, are there many situations more sublimely tragic than the struggle of the soul with the demand to renounce a work which has been all the significance of its life, a significance which is to vanish as the waters which come and go where no man has need of them? But there was nothing to strike others as sublime about Mr. Casaubon, and Lydgate, who had some contempt at hand for futile scholarship, felt a little amusement mingling with his pity. He was at present too ill acquainted with disaster to enter into the pathos of a lot where everything is below the level of tragedy, except the passionate egoism of the sufferer. "You refer to the possible hindrances from want of health," he said, wishing to help forward Mr. Casaubon's purpose, which seemed to be clogged by some hesitation.
"I do. You have not implied to me that the symptoms which I am bound to testify you watched with scrupulous care were those of a fatal disease. But were it so, Mr. Lydgate, I should desire to know the truth without reservation, and I appeal to you for an exact statement of your conclusions. I request it as a friendly service. If you can tell me that my life is not threatened by anything else than ordinary casualties, I shall rejoice on grounds which I have already indicated. If not, knowledge of the truth is even more important to me."
"Then I can no longer hesitate as to my course," said Lydgate. "But the first thing I must impress on you is that my conclusions are doubly uncertain. Uncertain not only because of my fallibility, but because diseases of the heart are eminently difficult to found predictions on. In any case, one can hardly increase appreciably the tremendous uncertainty of life." Mr. Casaubon winced perceptibly, but bowed. "I believe that you are suffering from what is called fatty degeneration of the heart, a disease which was first divined and explored by Laennec, the man who gave us the stethoscope, not so very many years ago. A good deal of experience, a more lengthened observation is wanted on the subject. But after what you have said, it is my duty to tell you that death from this disease is often sudden. At the same time, no such result can be predicted. Your condition may be consistent with a tolerably comfortable life for another 15 years, or even more. I could add no information to this, beyond anatomical or medical details, which would leave expectation at precisely the same point." Lydgate's instinct was fine enough to tell him that plain speech, quite free from ostentatious caution, would be felt by Mr. Casaubon as a tribute of respect.
"I thank you, Mr. Lydgate," said Mr. Casaubon after a moment's pause. "One thing more I have still to ask. Did you communicate what you have now told me to Mrs. Casaubon?"
"Partly. I mean, as to the possible issues." Lydgate was going to explain why he had told Dorothea, but Mr. Casaubon, with an unmistakable desire to end the conversation, waved his hand slightly and said again, "I thank you," proceeding to remark on the rare beauty of the day. Lydgate, certain that his patient wished to be alone, soon left him, and the black figure with hands behind and head bent forward continued to pace the walk, where the dark yew-trees gave him a mute companionship in melancholy, and the little shadows of bird or leaf that fleeted across the aisles of sunlight stole along in silence, as in the presence of a sorrow. Here was a man who now, for the first time, found himself looking into the eyes of death, who was passing through one of those rare moments of experience when we feel the truth of a commonplace, which is as different from what we call knowing it, as the vision of waters upon the earth is different from the delirious vision of the water which cannot be had to cool the burning tongue. When the commonplace, "We must all die," transforms itself suddenly into the acute consciousness, "I must die, and soon," Then death grapples us, and his fingers are cruel. Afterwards he may come to fold us in his arms as our mother did, and our last moment of dim earthly discerning may be like the first. To Mr. Casaubon now, it was as if he suddenly found himself on the dark river brink, and heard the plash of the oncoming oar, not discerning the forms, but expecting the summons. In such an hour, the mind does not change its lifelong bias, but carries it onwards in imagination to the other side of death, gazing backward, perhaps with the divine calm of beneficence, perhaps with the petty anxieties of self-assertion. What was Mr. Casaubon's bias, his acts will give us a clue to. He held himself to be, with some private scholarly reservations, a believing Christian, as to estimates of the present and hopes of the future. But what we strive to gratify, though we may call it a distant hope, is an immediate desire. The future estate for which men drudge up city alleys exists already in their imagination and love. And Mr. Casaubon's immediate desire was not for divine communion and light divested of earthly conditions. His passionate longings, poor man, clung low and mist-like in very shady places. Dorothea had been aware when Lydgate had ridden away, and she had stepped into the garden with the impulse to go at once to her husband. But she hesitated, fearing to offend him by obtruding herself. For her ardour, continually repulsed, served with her intense memory to heighten her dread, as thwarted energy subsides into a shudder. And she wandered slowly round the nearer clumps of trees until she saw him advancing. Then she went towards him, and might have represented a heaven-sent angel coming with a promise that the short hours remaining should yet be filled with that faithful love which clings the closer to a comprehended grief. His glance in reply to hers was so chill that she felt her timidity increased. Yet she turned and passed her hand through his arm. Mr. Casaubon kept his hands behind him, and allowed her pliant arm to cling with difficulty against his rigid arm. There was something horrible to Dorothea in the sensation which this unresponsive hardness inflicted on her. That is a strong word, but not too strong. It is in these acts called trivialities that the seeds of joy are forever wasted, until men and women look round with haggard faces at the devastation their own waste has made, and say the earth bears no harvest of sweetness, calling their denial knowledge. You may ask why, in the name of manliness, Mr. Casaubon should have behaved in that way. Consider that his was a mind which shrank from pity. Have you ever watched in such a mind the effect of a suspicion that what is pressing it as a grief may be really a source of contentment, either actual or future, to the being who already offends by pitying? Besides, he knew little of Dorothea's sensations, and had not reflected that on such an occasion as the present they were comparable in strength to his own sensibilities about Carp's criticisms. Dorothea did not withdraw her arm, but she could not venture to speak. Mr. Casaubon did not say, "I wish to be alone," but he directed his steps in silence towards the house. And as they entered by the glass door on this eastern side, Dorothea withdrew her arm, and lingered on the matting, that she might leave her husband quite free. He entered the library and shut himself in, alone with his sorrow. She went up to her boudoir. The open bow window let in the serene glory of the afternoon, lying in the avenue where the lime trees cast long shadows. But Dorothea knew nothing of the scene. She threw herself on a chair, not heeding that she was in the dazzling sun rays. If there were discomfort in that, how could she tell that it was not part of her inward misery? She was in the reaction of a rebellious anger stronger than any she had felt since her marriage. Instead of tears, there came words. "What have I done? What am I that he should treat me so? He never knows what is in my mind. He never cares. What is the use of anything I do? He wishes he had never married me." She began to hear herself, and was checked into stillness. Like one who has lost his way and is weary, She sat and saw, as in one glance, all the paths of her young hope, which she should never find again. And just as clearly in the miserable light, she saw her own and her husband's solitude. How they walked apart, so that she was obliged to survey him. If he had drawn her towards him, she would never have surveyed him, never have said, "Is he worth living for?" but would have felt him simply a part of her own life. Now, she said bitterly, "It is his fault, not mine." In the jar of her whole being, pity was overthrown. Was it her fault that she had believed in him, had believed in his worthiness? And what exactly was he? She was able enough to estimate him, she who waited on his glances with trembling and shut her best soul in prison, paying it only hidden visits, that she might be petty enough to please him. In such a crisis as this, some women begin to hate. The sun was low when Dorothea was thinking that she would not go down again, but would send a message to her husband saying that she was not well and preferred remaining upstairs. She had never deliberately allowed her resentment to govern her in this way before, but she believed now that she could not see him again without telling him the truth about her feeling, and she must wait till she could do it without interruption. He might wonder and be hurt at her message. It was good that he should wonder and be hurt. Her anger said, as anger is apt to say, that God was with her, that all heaven, though it were crowded with spirits watching them, must be on her side. She had determined to ring her bell when there came a rap at the door. Mr. Casaubon had sent to say that he would have his dinner in the library. He wished to be quite alone this evening, being much occupied. "I shall not dine then, Tantripp." "Oh, madam, let me bring you a little something." "No, I am not well. Get everything ready in my dressing room, but pray do not disturb me again." Dorothea sat almost motionless in her meditative struggle, while the evening slowly deepened into night. But the struggle changed continually, as that of a man who begins with a movement towards striking and ends with conquering his desire to strike. The energy that would animate a crime is not more than is wanted to inspire a resolved submission when the noble habit of the soul reasserts itself. That thought with which Dorothea had gone out to meet her husband, her conviction that he had been asking about the possible arrest of all his work, and that the answer must have wrung his heart, could not be long without rising beside the image of him, like a shadowy monitor, looking at her anger with sad remonstrance. It cost her a litany of pictured sorrows, and of silent cries that she might be the mercy for those sorrows. But the resolved submission did come. And when the house was still, and she knew that it was near the time when Mr. Casaubon habitually went to rest, she opened her door gently and stood outside in the darkness, waiting for his coming upstairs with a light in his hand. If he did not come soon, she thought that she would go down and even risk incurring another pang. She would never again expect anything else. But she did hear the library door open, and slowly the light advanced up the staircase without noise from the footsteps on the carpet. When her husband stood opposite to her, she saw that his face was more haggard. He started slightly on seeing her, and she looked up at him beseechingly, without speaking. "Dorothea," he said, with a gentle surprise in his tone, "were you waiting for me?"
"Yes. I did not like to disturb you."
"Come, my dear, come. You are young, and need not to extend your life by watching." When the kind, quiet melancholy of that speech fell on Dorothea's ears, she felt something like the thankfulness that might well up in us if we had narrowly escaped hurting a lamed creature. She put her hand into her husband's, and they went along the broad corridor together. Book 5. The Dead Hand. Chapter 43. Dorothea seldom left home without her husband, but she did occasionally drive into Middlemarch alone on little errands of shopping or charity, such as occur to every lady of any wealth when she lives within 3 miles of a town. 2 days after that scene in the yew tree walk, she determined to use such an opportunity in order, if possible, to see Lydgate and learn from him whether her husband had really felt any depressing change of symptoms which he was concealing from her, and whether he had insisted on knowing the utmost about himself. She felt almost guilty in asking for knowledge about him from another, but the dread of being without it, the dread of that ignorance which would make her unjust or hard, overcame every scruple. That there had been some crisis in her husband's mind, she was certain. He had the very next day begun a new method of arranging his notes, and had associated her quite newly in carrying out his plan. Poor Dorothea needed to lay up stores of patience. It was about 4 o'clock when she drove to Lydgate's house in Lowick Gate, wishing, in her immediate doubt of finding him at home, that she had written beforehand. And he was not at home. "Is Mrs. Lydgate at home?" said Dorothea, who had never that she knew of seen Rosamond, but now remembered the fact of the marriage. Yes, Mrs. Lydgate was at home. "I will go in and speak to her if she will allow me. Will you ask her if she can see me? See Mrs. Casaubon for a few minutes?" When the servant had gone to deliver that message, Dorothea could hear sounds of music through an open window, a few notes from a man's voice, and then a piano bursting into roulades. But the roulades broke off suddenly, and then the servant came back saying that Mrs. Lydgate would be happy to see Mrs. Casaubon. When the drawing-room door opened and Dorothea entered, there was a sort of contrast not infrequent in country life when the habits of the different ranks were less blent than now. Let those who know tell us exactly what stuff it was that Dorothea wore in those days of mild autumn. That thin white woollen stuff, soft to the touch and soft to the eye. It always seemed to have been lately washed and to smell of the sweet hedges. Was always in the shape of a pelisse, with sleeves hanging all out of the fashion. Yet, if she had entered before a still audience as Imogen or Cato's daughter, the dress might have seemed right enough. The grace and dignity were in her limbs and neck, and about her simply parted hair and candid eyes, the large round poke, which was then in the fate of women, seemed no more odd as a headdress than the gold trencher we call a halo. By the present audience of 2 persons, no dramatic heroine could have been expected with more interest than Mrs. Casaubon. To Rosamond, she was one of those county divinities not mixing with Middlemarch mortality, whose slightest marks of manner or appearance were worthy of her study. Moreover, Rosamond was not without satisfaction that Mrs. Casaubon should have an opportunity of studying her. What is the use of being exquisite if you are not seen by the best judges? And since Rosamond had received the highest compliments at Sir Godwin Lydgate's, she felt quite confident of the impression she must make on people of good birth. Dorothea put out her hand with her usual simple kindness and looked admiringly at Lydgate's lovely bride, aware that there was a gentleman standing at a distance, but seeing him merely as a coated figure at a wide angle. The gentleman was too much occupied with the presence of the one woman to reflect on the contrast between the two, a contrast that would certainly have been striking to a calm observer. They were both tall, and their eyes were on a level. But imagine Rosamond's infantine blondness and wondrous crown of hair plaits, with her pale blue dress of a fit and fashion so perfect that no dressmaker could look at it without emotion, a large embroidered collar, which it was to be hoped all beholders would know the price of, her small hands duly set off with rings, and that controlled self-consciousness of manner which is the expensive substitute for simplicity. "Thank you very much for allowing me to interrupt you," said Dorothea immediately. "I am anxious to see Mr. Lydgate, if possible, before I go home, and I hope that you might possibly tell me where I could find him, or even allow me to wait for him if you expect him soon."
"He is at the new hospital," said Rosamond. "I am not sure how soon he will come home, but I can send for him."
"Will you let me go and fetch him?" said Will Ladislaw, coming forward.
He had already taken up his hat before Dorothea entered. She coloured with surprise, but put out her hand with a smile of unmistakable pleasure, saying, "I did not know it was you. I had no thought of seeing you here."
"May I go to the hospital and tell Mr. Lydgate that you wish to see him?" said Will.
"It would be quicker to send the carriage for him," said Dorothea, "if you will be kind enough to give the message to the coachman."
Will was moving to the door, when Dorothea, whose mind had flashed in an instant over many connected memories, turned quickly and said,
"I will go myself, thank you. I wish to lose no time before getting home again. I will drive to the hospital and see Mr. Lydgate there. Pray excuse me, Mrs. Lydgate. I am very much obliged to you."
Her mind was evidently arrested by some sudden thought, and she left the room hardly conscious of what was immediately around her, hardly conscious that Will opened the door for her and offered her his arm to lead her to the carriage. She took the arm, but said nothing. Will was feeling rather vexed and miserable, and found nothing to say on his side. He handed her into the carriage in silence. They said goodbye, and Dorothea drove away. In the 5 minutes' drive to the hospital, she had time for some reflections that were quite new to her. Her decision to go, and her preoccupation in leaving the room, had come from the sudden sense that there would be a sort of deception in her voluntarily allowing any further intercourse between herself and Will, which she was unable to mention to her husband. And already her errand in seeking Lydgate was a matter of concealment. That was all that had been explicitly in her mind. But she had been urged also by a vague discomfort. Now that she was alone in her drive, she heard the notes of the man's voice and the accompanying piano, which she had not noted much at the time, returning on her inward sense. And she found herself thinking with some wonder that Will Ladislaw was passing his time with Mrs. Lydgate in her husband's absence. And then she could not help remembering that he had passed some time with her under like circumstances, so why should there be any unfitness in the fact? But Will was Mr. Casaubon's relative, and one towards whom she was bound to show kindness. Still, there had been signs, which perhaps she ought to have understood as implying that Mr. Casaubon did not like his cousin's visits during his own absence.
"Perhaps I have been mistaken in many things," said poor Dorothea to herself, while the tears came rolling, and she had to dry them quickly. She felt confusedly unhappy, and the image of Will, which had been so clear to her before, was mysteriously spoiled.
But the carriage stopped at the gate of the hospital. She was soon walking round the grass plots with Lydgate, and her feelings recovered the strong bent which had made her seek for this interview. Will Ladislaw, meanwhile, was mortified, and knew the reason of it clearly enough. His chances of meeting Dorothea were rare, and here, for the first time, there had come a chance which had set him at a disadvantage. It was not only, as it had been hitherto, that she was not supremely occupied with him, but that she had seen him under circumstances in which he might appear not to be supremely occupied with her. He felt thrust to a new distance from her, amongst the circles of Middlemarchers who made no part of her life. But that was not his fault. Of course, since he had taken his lodgings in the town, he had been making as many acquaintances as he could, his position requiring that he should know everybody and everything. Lydgate was really better worth knowing than anyone else in the neighbourhood, and he happened to have a wife who was musical and altogether worth calling upon. Here was the whole history of the situation in which Diana had descended too unexpectedly on her worshipper. It was mortifying. Will was conscious that he should not have been at Middlemarch but for Dorothea, and yet his position there was threatening to divide him from her, with those barriers of habitual sentiment which are more fatal to the persistence of mutual interest than all the distance between Rome and Britain. Prejudices about rank and status were easy enough to defy in the form of a tyrannical letter from Mr. Casaubon. But prejudices, like odorous bodies, have a double existence, both solid and subtle. Solid as the pyramids, subtle as the 20th echo of an echo, or as the memory of hyacinths which once scented the darkness. And Will was of a temperament to feel keenly the presence of subtleties. A man of clumsier perceptions would not have felt as he did that for the first time some sense of unfitness in perfect freedom with him had sprung up in Dorothea's mind, and that their silence as he conducted her to the carriage had had a chill in it. Perhaps Casaubon, in his hatred and jealousy, had been insisting to Dorothea that Will had slid below her socially. Confound Casaubon! Will re-entered the drawing-room, took up his hat, and looking irritated as he advanced towards Mrs. Lydgate, who had seated herself at her work-table, said, "It is always fatal to have music or poetry interrupted. May I come another day and just finish about the rendering of Lungi dal caro bene?"
"I shall be happy to be taught," said Rosamond. "But I am sure you admit that the interruption was a very beautiful one. I quite envy your acquaintance with Mrs. Casaubon. Is she very clever? She looks as if she were."
"Really, I never thought about it," said Will sulkily.
"That is just the answer Tertius gave me when I first asked him if she were handsome. What is it that you gentlemen are thinking of when you are with Mrs. Casaubon?"
"Herself," said Will, not indisposed to provoke the charming Mrs. Lydgate. "When one sees a perfect woman, one never thinks of her attributes, one is conscious of her presence."
"I shall be jealous when Tertius goes to Lowick," said Rosamond, dimpling and speaking with airy lightness. "He will come back and think nothing of me."
That does not seem to have been the effect on Lydgate hitherto. Mrs. Casaubon is too unlike other women for them to be compared with her.
"You are a devout worshipper, I perceive. You often see her, I suppose?"
"No," said Will, almost pettishly. "Worship is usually a matter of theory rather than of practice."
"But I am practicing it to excess just at this moment. I must really tear myself away." "Pray come again some evening. Mr. Lydgate will like to hear the music, and I cannot enjoy it so well without him."
When her husband was at home again, Rosamond said, standing in front of him and holding his coat collar with both her hands,
"Mr. Ladislaw was here singing with me when Mrs. Casaubon came in. He seemed vexed. Do you think he disliked her seeing him at our house? Surely your position is more than equal to his, whatever may be his relation to the Casaubons."
"No, no. It must be something else if he were really vexed. Ladislaw is a sort of gypsy. He thinks nothing of leather and prunella."
"Music apart, he is not always very agreeable. Do you like him?"
"Yes, I think he's a good fellow. Rather miscellaneous and bric-a-brac, but likeable."
"Do you know, I think he adores Mrs. Casaubon?"
"Poor devil," said Lydgate, smiling and pinching his wife's ears. Rosamond felt herself beginning to know a great deal of the world, especially in discovering what, when she was in her unmarried girlhood, had been inconceivable to her, except as a dim tragedy in bygone costumes, that women, even after marriage, might make conquests and enslave men. At that time, young ladies in the country, even when educated at Mrs. Lemon's, read little French literature later than Racine, and public print had not cast their present magnificent illumination over the scandals of life. Still, vanity, with a woman's whole mind and day to work in, can construct abundantly on slight hints, especially on such a hint as the possibility of indefinite conquests. How delightful to make captives from the throne of marriage with a husband as crown prince by your side, himself, in fact, a subject, while the captives look up forever hopeless, losing their rest, probably, and if their appetite, too, so much the better. But Rosamond's romance turned, at present, chiefly on her crown prince, and it was enough to enjoy his assured subjection. When he said, "Poor devil," she asked with playful curiosity,
"Why so?"
"Why, what can a man do when he takes to adoring one of you mermaids? He only neglects his work and runs up bills."
"I am sure you do not neglect your work. You are always at the hospital, or seeing poor patients, or thinking about some doctor's quarrel. And then at home you always want to pore over your microscope and files. Confess, you like those things better than me."
"Haven't you ambition enough to wish that your husband should be something better than a Middlemarch doctor?" said Lydgate, letting his hands fall onto his wife's shoulders and looking at her with affectionate gravity. "I shall make you learn my favourite bit from an old poet. Why should our pride make such a stir to be and be forgot? What good is like to this, to do worthy the writing, and to write worthy the reading and the world's delight? What I want, Rosie, is to do worthy the writing, and to write out myself what I have done. A man must work to do that, my pet."
"Of course I wish you to make discoveries. No one could more wish you to attain a high position in some better place than Middlemarch. You cannot say that I have ever tried to hinder you from working. But we cannot live like hermits. You are not discontented with me, Tertius?"
"No, dear, no. I am too entirely contented."
"But what did Mrs. Casaubon want to say to you?"
"Merely to ask about her husband's health. But I think she is going to be splendid to our new hospital. I think she will give us 200 a year."
Chapter 44. When Dorothea, walking round the laurel-planted plots of the new hospital with Lydgate, had learned from him that there were no signs of change in Mr. Casaubon's bodily condition beyond the mental sign of anxiety to know the truth about his illness, she was silent for a few moments, wondering whether she had said or done anything to rouse this new anxiety. Lydgate, not willing to let slip an opportunity of furthering a favourite purpose, ventured to say, "I don't know whether your or Mr. Casaubon's attention has been drawn to the needs of our new hospital. Circumstances have made it seem rather egotistic in me to urge the subject, but that is not my fault. It is because there is a fight being made against it by the other medical men. I think you are generally interested in such things, for I remember that when I first had the pleasure of seeing you at Tipton Grange before your marriage, you were asking me some questions about the way in which the health of the poor was affected by their miserable housing."
"Yes, indeed," said Dorothea, brightening. "I shall be quite grateful to you if you will tell me how I can help to make things a little better. Everything of that sort has slipped away from me since I have been married. I mean," she said, after a moment's hesitation, "that the people in our village are tolerably comfortable, and my mind has been too much taken up for me to inquire further. But here, in such a place as Middlemarch, there must be a great deal to be done."
"There is everything to be done," said Lydgate with abrupt energy. "And this hospital is a capital piece of work, due entirely to Mr. Bulstrode's exertions, and in a great degree to his money. But one man can't do everything in a scheme of this sort. Of course, he looked forward to help. And now there's a mean, petty feud set up against the thing in the town by certain persons who want to make it a failure."
"What can be their reasons?" said Dorothea, with naive surprise.
"Chiefly Mr. Bulstrode's unpopularity, to begin with. Half the town would almost take trouble for the sake of thwarting him. In this stupid world, most people never consider that a thing is good to be done unless it is done by their own set. I had no connection with Bulstrode before I came here. I look at him quite impartially, and I see that he has some notions, that he has set things on foot, which I can turn to good public purpose. If a fair number of the better-educated men went to work with the belief that their observations might contribute to the reform of medical doctrine and practice, we should soon see a change for the better. That's my point of view. I hold that by refusing to work with Mr. Bulstrode, I should be turning my back on an opportunity of making my profession more generally serviceable."
"I quite agree with you," said Dorothea, at once fascinated by the situation sketched in Lydgate's words. "But what is there against Mr. Bulstrode? I know that my uncle is friendly with him."
"People don't like his religious tone," said Lydgate, breaking off there.
"That is all the stronger reason for despising such an opposition," said Dorothea, looking at the affairs of Middlemarch by the light of the great persecutions.
"To put the matter quite fairly, they have other objections to him. He is masterful and rather unsociable, and he is concerned with trade, which has complaints of its own that I know nothing about. But what has that to do with the question whether it would not be a fine thing to establish here a more valuable hospital than any they have in the county? The immediate motive to the opposition, however, is the fact that Bulstrode has put the medical direction into my hands. Of course, I am glad of that. It gives me an opportunity of doing some good work, and I am aware that I have to justify his choice of me. But the consequence is that the whole profession in Middlemarch have set themselves tooth and nail against the hospital, and not only refuse to cooperate themselves, but try to blacken the whole affair and hinder subscriptions.
"How very petty!" exclaimed Dorothea indignantly.
"I suppose one must expect to fight one's way. There is hardly anything to be done without it. And the ignorance of people about here is stupendous. I don't lay claim to anything else than having used some opportunities which have not come within everybody's reach. But there is no stifling the offence of being young and a newcomer and happening to know something more than the old inhabitants. Still, if I believe that I can set going a better method of treatment, if I believe that I can pursue certain observations and inquiries which may be a lasting benefit to medical practice, I should be a base truckler if I allowed any consideration of personal comfort to hinder me. And the course is all the clearer from there being no salary in question to put my persistence in an equivocal light."
"I am glad you have told me this, Mr. Lydgate," said Dorothea cordially. "I feel sure I can help a little. I have some money and don't know what to do with it. That is often an uncomfortable thought to me. I am sure I can spare 200 a year for a grand purpose like this. How happy you must be to know things that you feel sure will do great good. I wish I could awake with that knowledge every morning. There seems to be so much trouble taken that one can hardly see the good of." There was a melancholy cadence in Dorothea's voice as she spoke these last words. But she presently added, more cheerfully, "Pray come to Lowick and tell us more of this. I will mention the subject to Mr. Casaubon. I must hasten home now." She did mention it that evening, and said that she should like to subscribe 200 a year. She had 700 a year as the equivalent of her own fortune settled on her at her marriage. Mr. Casaubon made no objection, beyond a passing remark that the sum might be disproportionate in relation to other good objects. But when Dorothea, in her ignorance, resisted that suggestion, he acquiesced. He did not care himself about spending money, and was not reluctant to give it. If he ever felt keenly any question of money, it was through the medium of another passion than the love of material property. Dorothea told him that she had seen Lydgate, and recited the gist of her conversation with him about the hospital. Mr. Casaubon did not question her further, but he felt sure that she had wished to know what had passed between Lydgate and himself. "She knows that I know," said the ever-restless voice within. But that increase of tacit knowledge only thrust further off any confidence between them. He distrusted her affection. And what loneliness is more lonely than distrust? Chapter 45. That opposition to the new fever hospital which Lydgate had sketched to Dorothea was, like other oppositions, to be viewed in many different lights. He regarded it as a mixture of jealousy and dunder-headed prejudice. Mr. Bulstrode saw in it not only medical jealousy, but a determination to thwart himself, prompted mainly by a hatred of that vital religion of which he had striven to be an effectual lay representative. A hatred which certainly found pretexts apart from religion, such as were only too easy to find in the entanglements of human action. These might be called the ministerial views. But oppositions have the illimitable range of objections at command, which need never stop short at the boundary of knowledge, but can draw for ever on the vasts of ignorance. What the opposition in Middlemarch said about the new hospital and its administration had certainly a great deal of echo in it, for heaven has taken care that everybody shall not be an originator. But there were differences which represented every social shade between the polished moderation of Dr. Minchin and the trenchant assertion of Mrs. Dollop, the landlady of the tankard in Slaughter Lane. Mrs. Dollop became more and more convinced by her own asseveration that Dr. Lydgate meant to let the people die in the hospital, if not to poison them, for the sake of cutting them up without saying by your leave or with your leave,
for it was a known fact that he had wanted to cut up Mrs. Goby, as respectable a woman as any in Parley Street, who had money in trust before her marriage. A poor tale for a doctor, who, if he was good for anything, should know what was the matter with you before you died, and not want to pry into your inside after you were gone. If that was not reason, Mrs. Dollop wished to know what was. But there was a prevalent feeling in her audience that her opinion was a bulwark, and that if it were overthrown, there would be no limits to the cutting up of bodies, as had been well seen in Burke and Hare, with their pitch plaisters. Such a hanging business as that was not wanted in Middlemarch. And let it not be supposed that opinion of the tankard in Slaughter Lane was unimportant to the medical profession. That old authentic public house, the original tankard known by the name of Dollops, was the resort of a great benefit club, which had some months before put to the vote whether its long-standing medical man, Dr. Gambit, should not be cashiered in favour of this Dr. Lydgate, who was capable of performing the most astonishing cures and rescuing people altogether given up by other practitioners. But the balance had been turned against Lydgate by two members who, for some private reasons, held that this power of resuscitating persons as good as dead was an equivocal recommendation and might interfere with providential favours. In the course of the year, however, there had been a change in the public sentiment, of which the unanimity at Dollops was an index. A good deal more than a year ago, before anything was known of Lydgate's skill, the judgments on it had naturally been divided, depending on a sense of likelihood, situated perhaps in the pit of the stomach or in the pineal gland, and differing in its verdicts, but not the less valuable as a guide in the total deficit of evidence. Patients who had chronic diseases, or whose lives had long been worn threadbare like old Featherstone's, had been at once inclined to try him. Also, many who did not like paying their doctor's bills thought agreeably of opening an account with a new doctor and sending for him without stint if the children's temper wanted a dose, occasions when the old practitioners were often crusty. And all persons thus inclined to employ Lydgate held it likely that he was clever. Some considered that he might do more than others where there was liver. At least there would be no harm in getting a few bottles of stuff from him, since if these proved useless, it would still be possible to return to the purifying pills which kept you alive if they did not remove the yellowness. But these were people of minor importance. Good Middlemarch families were, of course, not going to change their doctor without reason shown, and everybody who had employed Mr. Peacock did not feel obliged to accept a new man merely in the character of his successor, objecting that he was not likely to be equal to Peacock. But Lydgate had not been long in the town before there were particulars enough reported of him to breed much more specific expectations, and to intensify differences into partisanship. Some of the particulars being of that impressive order of which the significance is entirely hidden, like a statistical amount without a standard of comparison, but with a note of exclamation at the end. The cubic feet of oxygen yearly swallowed by a full-grown man. What a shudder they might have created in some Middlemarch circles. Oxygen? Nobody knows what that may be. Is it any wonder the cholera has got to Danzig? And yet there are people who say quarantine is no good. One of the facts quickly rumoured was that Lydgate did not dispense drugs. This was offensive both to the physicians, whose exclusive distinction seemed infringed on, and to the surgeon apothecaries with whom he ranged himself. And only a little while before they might have counted on having the law on their side, against a man who, without calling himself a London-made M.D., dared to ask for pay except as a charge on drugs. But Lydgate had not been experienced enough to foresee that his new course would be even more offensive to the laity. And to Mr. Malmsey, an important grocer in the top market, who, though not one of his patients, questioned him in an affable manner on the subject, he was injudicious enough to give a hasty popular explanation of his reasons, pointing out to Mr. Malmsey that it must lower the character of practitioners and be a constant injury to the public if their only mode of getting paid for their work was by their making out long bills for draughts, boluses, and mixtures. "It is in that way that hard-working medical men may come to be almost as mischievous as quacks," said Lydgate, rather thoughtlessly. To get their own bread, they must overdose the king's lieges. And that's a bad sort of treason, Mr. Malmsey. Undermines the constitution in a fatal way.
Mr. Malmsey was not only an overseer. It was about a question of outdoor pay that he was having an interview with Lydgate. He was also asthmatic and had an increasing family. Thus, from a medical point of view as well as from his own, he was an important man. Indeed, an exceptional grocer, whose hair was arranged in a flame-like pyramid, and whose retail deference was of the cordial, encouraging kind, jocosely complimentary, and with a certain considerate abstinence from letting out the full force of his mind. It was Mr. Malmsey's friendly jocoseness in questioning him which had set the tone of Lydgate's reply. But let the wise be warned against too great readiness at explanation. It multiplies the sources of mistake, lengthening the sum for reckoners sure to go wrong. Lydgate smiled as he ended his speech, putting his foot into the stirrup, and Mr. Malmsey laughed more than he would have done if he had known who the king's lieges were, giving his good morning, sir, with the air of one who saw everything clearly enough. But in truth, his views were perturbed. For years he had been paying bills with strictly made items, so that for every half-crown and 18 pence he was certain something measurable had been delivered. He had done this with satisfaction, including it among his responsibilities as a husband and father, and regarding a longer bill than usual as a dignity worth mentioning. Moreover, in addition to the massive benefit of the drugs to self and family, he had enjoyed the pleasure of forming an acute judgment as to their immediate effects, so as to give an intelligent statement for the guidance of Mr. Gambit, a practitioner just a little lower in status than Wrench or Toller, and especially esteemed as an accoucheur, of whose ability Mr. Malmsey had the poorest opinion on all other points. But in doctoring, he was wont to say in an undertone, he placed Gambit above any of them. Here were deeper reasons than the superficial talk of a new man, which appeared still flimsier in the drawing-room over the shop, when they were recited to Mrs. Malmsey, a woman accustomed to be made much of as a fertile mother, generally under attendance more or less frequent from Mr. Gambit, and occasionally having attacks which required Dr. Minchin.
"Does this Mr. Lydgate mean to say there is no use in taking medicine?" said Mrs. Malmsey, who was slightly given to drawling. "I should like him to tell me how I could bear up at fair time if I didn't take strengthening medicine for a month beforehand. Think of what I have to provide for calling customers, my dear."
Here Mrs. Malmsey turned to an intimate female friend who sat by.
"A large veal pie, a stuffed fillet, a round of beef, ham, tongue, etc., etc. But what keeps me up best is the pink mixture, not the brown. I wonder, Mr. Malmsey, with your experience, you could have patience to listen. I should have told him at once that I knew a little better than that."
"No, no, no," said Mr. Malmsey. "I was not going to tell him my opinion. Hear everything and judge for yourself is my motto. But he didn't know who he was talking to. I was not to be turned on his finger. People often pretend to tell me things when they might as well say, 'Malmsey, you're a fool.' But I smile at it. I humour everybody's weak place. If physic had done harm to self and family, I should have found it out by this time."
The next day, Mr. Gambit was told that Lydgate went about saying physic was of no use.
"Indeed," said he, lifting his eyebrows with cautious surprise. He was a stout, husky man with a large ring on his fourth finger. "How will he cure his patients, then?"
"That is what I say," returned Mrs. Malmsey, who habitually gave weight to her speech by loading her pronouns. "Does he suppose that people will pay him only to come and sit with them and go away again?"
Mrs. Malmsey had had a great deal of sitting from Mr. Gambit, including very full accounts of his own habits of body and other affairs. But, of course, he knew there was no innuendo in her remark, since his spare time and personal narrative had never been charged for. So he replied humorously,
"Well, Lydgate is a good-looking young fellow, you know."
"Not one that I would employ," said Mrs. Malmsey. "Others may do as they please."
Hence Mr. Gambit could go away from the chief grocer's without fear of rivalry, but not without a sense that Lydgate was one of those hypocrites who try to discredit others by advertising their own honesty, and that it might be worth some people's while to show him up. Mr. Gambit, however, had a satisfactory practice, much pervaded by the smells of retail trading, which suggested the reduction of cash payments to a balance, and he did not think it worth his while to show Lydgate up until he knew how. He had not indeed great resources of education, and had had to work his own way against a good deal of professional contempt. But he made none the worse accoucheur for calling the breathing apparatus lungs. Other medical men felt themselves more capable. Mr. Toller shared the highest practice in the town and belonged to an old Middlemarch family. There were Tollers in the law and everything else above the line of retail trade. Unlike our irascible friend Wrench, he had the easiest way in the world of taking things which might be supposed to annoy him, being a well-bred, quietly facetious man who kept a good house, was very fond of a little sporting when he could get it, very friendly with Mr. Hawley and hostile to Mr. Bulstrode. It may seem odd that with such pleasant habits he should have been given to the heroic treatment, bleeding and blistering and starving his patients with a dispassionate disregard to his personal example. But the incongruity favoured the opinion of his ability among his patients, who commonly observed that Mr. Toller had lazy manners, but his treatment was as active as you could desire. No man, said they, carried more seriousness into his profession. He was a little slow in coming, but when he came, he did something. He was a great favourite in his own circle, and whatever he implied to anyone's disadvantage told doubly from his careless, ironical tone. He naturally got tired of smiling and saying, "Ah," when he was told that Mr. Peacock's successor did not mean to dispense medicines. And, Mr. Hackbutt one day mentioning it over the wine at a dinner party, Mr. Toller said laughingly, "Dibbets will get rid of his stale drugs then. I'm fond of little Dibbets. I'm glad he's in luck." "I see your meaning, Toller," said Mr. Hackbutt, "and I am entirely of your opinion. I shall take an opportunity of expressing myself to that effect. A medical man should be responsible for the quality of the drugs consumed by his patients. That is the rationale of the system of charging which has hitherto obtained, and nothing is more offensive than this ostentation of reform where there is no real amelioration." "Ostentation, Hackbutt?" said Mr. Toller ironically. "I don't see that. A man can't very well be ostentatious of what nobody believes in. There is no reform in the matter. The question is whether the profit on the drugs is paid to the medical man by the druggist or by the patient, and whether there shall be extra pay under the name of attendance."
"Oh, to be sure. One of your damned new versions of old humbug," said Mr. Hawley, passing the decanter to Mr. Wrench.
Mr. Wrench, generally abstemious, often drank wine rather freely at a party, getting the more irritable in consequence. "As to humbug, Hawley," he said, "that's a word easy to fling about. But what I contend against is the way medical men are fouling their own nest and setting up a cry about the country as if a general practitioner who dispenses drugs couldn't be a gentleman. I throw back the imputation with scorn. I say the most ungentlemanly trick a man can be guilty of is to come among the members of his profession with innovations which are a libel on their time-honoured procedure. That is my opinion, and I am ready to maintain it against anyone who contradicts me." Mr. Wrench's voice had become exceedingly sharp.
"I can't oblige you there, Wrench," said Mr. Hawley,
thrusting his hands into his trouser pockets.
"My dear fellow," said Mr. Toller, striking in pacifically and looking at Mr. Wrench, "the physicians have their toes trodden on more than we have. If you come to dignity, it is a question for Minchin and Sprague."
"Does medical jurisprudence provide nothing against these infringements?" said Mr. Hackbutt, with a disinterested desire to offer his lights. "How does the law stand, eh, Hawley?"
"Nothing to be done there," said Mr. Hawley. "I looked into it for Sprague. You'd only break your nose against a damned judge's decision."
"Phew! No need of law," said Mr. Toller. "So far as practice is concerned, the attempt is an absurdity. No patient will like it, certainly not Peacocks, who have been used to depletion.
Pass the wine. Mr. Toller's prediction was partly verified. If Mr. and Mrs. Malmsey, who had no idea of employing Lydgate, were made uneasy by his supposed declaration against drugs, it was inevitable that those who called him in should watch a little anxiously to see whether he did use all the means he might use in the case. Even good Mr. Powderall, who in his constant charity of interpretation was inclined to esteem Lydgate the more for what seemed a conscientious pursuit of a better plan, had his mind disturbed with doubts during his wife's attack of erysipelas, and could not abstain from mentioning to Lydgate that Mr. Peacock, on a similar occasion, had administered a series of boluses, which were not otherwise definable than by their remarkable effect in bringing Mrs. Powderall round before Michaelmas from an illness which had begun in a remarkably hot August. At last, indeed, in the conflict between his desire not to hurt Lydgate and his anxiety that no means should be lacking, he induced his wife privately to take Widgeon's Purifying Pills, an esteemed Middlemarch medicine which arrested every disease at the fountain by setting to work at once upon the blood. This cooperative measure was not to be mentioned to Lydgate, and Mr. Powderall himself had no certain reliance on it, only hoping that it might be attended with a blessing. But in this doubtful stage of Lydgate's introduction, he was helped by what we mortals rashly call good fortune. I suppose no doctor ever came newly to a place without making cures that surprised somebody, cures which may be called fortune's testimonials, and deserve as much credit as the written or printed kind. Various patients got well while Lydgate was attending them, some even of dangerous illnesses, and it was remarked that the new doctor, with his new ways, had at least the merit of bringing people back from the brink of death. The trash talked on such occasions was the more vexatious to Lydgate because it gave precisely the sort of prestige which an incompetent and unscrupulous man would desire, and was sure to be imputed to him by the simmering dislike of the other medical men as an encouragement on his own part of ignorant puffing. But even his proud outspokenness was checked by the discernment that it was as useless to fight against the interpretations of ignorance as to whip the fog, and good fortune insisted on using those interpretations. Mrs. Larcher, having just become charitably concerned about alarming symptoms in her charwoman, when Dr. Minchin called, asked him to see her then and there, and to give her a certificate for the infirmary. Whereupon, after examination, he wrote a statement of the case as one of tumour, and recommended the bearer Nancy Nash as an outpatient. Nancy, calling at home on her way to the infirmary, allowed the staymaker and his wife, in whose attic she lodged, to read Dr. Minchin's paper, and by this means became a subject of compassionate conversation in the neighbouring shops of Churchyard Lane as being afflicted with a tumour at first declared to be as large and hard as a duck's egg, but later in the day to be about the size of your fist. Most hearers agreed that it would have to be cut out, but one had known of oil and another of squitchineal as adequate to soften and reduce any lump in the body when taken enough of into the inside, the oil by gradually soupling, the squitchineal by eating away. Meanwhile, when Nancy presented herself at the infirmary, it happened to be one of Lydgate's days there. After questioning and examining her, Lydgate said to the house surgeon in an undertone, "It's not tumour, it's cramp." He ordered her a blister and some steel mixture and told her to go home and rest, giving her at the same time a note to Mrs. Larcher, who she said was her best employer, to testify that she was in need of good food. But by and by Nancy in her attic became portentously worse, the supposed tumour having indeed given way to the blister, but only wandered to another region with angrier pain. The staymaker's wife went to fetch Lydgate, and he continued for a fortnight to attend Nancy in her own home, until under his treatment she got quite well and went to work again. But the case continued to be described as one of tumour in Churchyard Lane and other streets, nay, by Mrs. Larcher also. For when Lydgate's remarkable cure was mentioned to Dr. Minchin, he naturally did not like to say, "The case was not one of tumour, and I was mistaken in describing it as such," but answered, "Indeed, ah, I saw it was a surgical case, not of a fatal kind."
He had been inwardly annoyed, however, when he had asked at the infirmary about the woman he had recommended 2 days before, to hear from the house surgeon, a youngster who was not sorry to vex Minchin with impunity, exactly what had occurred. He privately pronounced that it was indecent in a general practitioner to contradict a physician's diagnosis in that open manner, and afterwards agreed with Wrench that Lydgate was disagreeably inattentive to etiquette. Lydgate did not make the affair a ground for valuing himself, or very particularly despising Minchin, such rectification of misjudgments often happening among men of equal qualifications. But report took up this amazing case of tumour, not clearly distinguished from cancer and considered the more awful for being of the wandering sort, till much prejudice against Lydgate's method as to drugs was overcome by the proof of his marvellous skill in the speedy restoration of Nancy Nash after she had been rolling and rolling in agonies from the presence of a tumour both hard and obstinate, but nevertheless compelled to yield. How could Lydgate help himself? It is offensive to tell a lady, when she is expressing her amazement at your skill, that she is altogether mistaken and rather foolish in her amazement. And to have entered into the nature of diseases would only have added to his breaches of medical propriety. Thus he had to wince under a promise of success given by that ignorant praise which misses every valid quality. In the case of a more conspicuous patient, Mr. Borthrop Trumbull, Lydgate was conscious of having shown himself something better than an everyday doctor, though here, too, it was an equivocal advantage that he won. The eloquent auctioneer was seized with pneumonia, and having been a patient of Mr. Peacock's, sent for Lydgate, whom he had expressed his intention to patronise. Mr. Trumbull was a robust man, a good subject for trying the expectant theory upon, watching the course of an interesting disease when left as much as possible to itself, so that the stages might be noted for future guidance. And from the air with which he described his sensations, Lydgate surmised that he would like to be taken into his medical man's confidence and be represented as a partner in his own cure. The auctioneer heard, without much surprise, that his was a constitution which, always with due watching, might be left to itself, so as to offer a beautiful example of a disease with all its phases seen in clear delineation, and that he probably had the rare strength of mind voluntarily to become the test of a rational procedure, and thus make the disorder of his pulmonary functions a general benefit to society. Mr. Trumbull acquiesced at once, and entered strongly into the view that an illness of his was no ordinary occasion for medical science.
"Never fear, sir. You are not speaking to one who is altogether ignorant of the vis medicatrix," said he, with his usual superiority of expression, made rather pathetic by difficulty of breathing. And he went without shrinking through his abstinence from drugs, much sustained by application of the thermometer, which implied the importance of his temperature, by the sense that he furnished objects for the microscope, and by learning many new words which seemed suited to the dignity of his secretions. For Lydgate was acute enough to indulge him with a little technical talk. It may be imagined that Mr. Trumbull rose from his couch with a disposition to speak of an illness in which he had manifested the strength of his mind as well as constitution, and he was not backward in awarding credit to the medical man who had discerned the quality of patient he had to deal with. The auctioneer was not an ungenerous man, and liked to give others their due, feeling that he could afford it. He had caught the words expectant method, and rang chimes on this and other learned phrases, to accompany the assurance that Lydgate knew a thing or two more than the rest of the doctors, was far better versed in the secrets of his profession than the majority of his compeers. This had happened before the affair of Fred Vincey's illness had given to Mr. Wrench's enmity towards Lydgate more definite personal ground. The newcomer already threatened to be a nuisance in the shape of rivalry, and was certainly a nuisance in the shape of practical criticism or reflections on his hard-driven elders, who had had something else to do than to busy themselves with untried notions. His practice had spread in one or two quarters, and from the first, the report of his high family had led to his being pretty generally invited, so that the other medical men had to meet him at dinner in the best houses, and having to meet a man whom you dislike is not observed always to end in mutual attachment. There was hardly ever so much unanimity among them,
as in the opinion that Lydgate was an arrogant young fellow, and yet ready, for the sake of ultimately predominating, to show a crawling subservience to Bulstrode. That Mr. Fairbrother, whose name was a chief flag of the anti-Bulstrode party, always defended Lydgate and made a friend of him, was referred to Fairbrother's unaccountable way of fighting on both sides. Here was plenty of preparation for the outburst of professional disgust at the announcement of the laws Mr. Bulstrode was laying down for the direction of the new hospital, which were the more exasperating because there was no present possibility of interfering with his will and pleasure, everybody except Lord Medlicott having refused help towards the building on the ground that they preferred giving to the old infirmary. Mr. Bulstrode met all the expenses, and had ceased to be sorry that he was purchasing the right to carry out his notions of improvement without hindrance from prejudiced coadjutors. But he had had to spend large sums, and the building had lingered. Caleb Garth had undertaken it, had failed during its progress, and before the interior fittings were begun, had retired from the management of the business. And when referring to the hospital, he often said that however Bulstrode might ring if you tried him, he liked good solid carpentry and masonry, and had a notion both of drains and chimneys. In fact, the hospital had become an object of intense interest to Bulstrode, and he would willingly have continued to spare a large yearly sum that he might rule it dictatorially without any board. But he had another favourite object which also required money for its accomplishment. He wished to buy some land in the neighbourhood of Middlemarch, and therefore he wished to get considerable contributions towards maintaining the hospital.
End of disc 14.